And welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday.
Yeah,
Tuesday. Tuesday evening for some of you on the East Coast and afternoon for those of us here on the West Coast. Three topics, at least a possible fourth, depending on whether I get done with each of the other two, which is possible. I might make it. We'll try. Lots of interesting things to get to here. I'm going to start with announcement. Generally, it doesn't work this way. Generally, it does not work this way. Some of you may recall you're moving the microphone, and so you're looking.
Does
like,
that make you nervous?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, it does. Is there something you wanted to? Oh, okay, good. Some of you remember a little while back I reviewed the Flaming Toilet of Death, Peter Hyatt's video. And that was because it had been played by the fellow up in Salt Lake City that I haven't heard a word about in ages now. So that was probably March, April, somewhere around there. Well, we didn't arrange a debate this trip up to Colorado because I leave next week and I go up to Santa Fe. I'm going to be speaking in Santa Fe. We've got information up on the website about that. And seeing Paul Scazzafava, say that three times fast, and the guys there at the church where I've been, well, that's the only church I've been to in Santa Fe, actually. I don't know if there are any other churches in Santa Fe. That's just where I go, and the poor people there, they actually like me. I don't know. they call it the Discern Conference. Having me in all the time, I'm not sure if that's showing a lot of discernment, but anyway. And then from there up to Colorado, which is my want during the middle of the year, as you may have noticed over the past few years. And I'm going to be doing some insane climbing on a bike up there, like up to the ski station in Santa Fe. That's only 10-1. I am going up Mount Evans, Lord willing, maybe more than once. And Mount Evans is 14,000 feet above sea level, and so I've never been that high on a bike. Could be interesting, but I'm looking forward to it. But anyways, we were going to try to work something out with Peter Hyatt. We might still be able to do so. We're actually going to get together while I'm up there at some point for September with Peter Hyatt, I hope, on the subject of universalism. So I was a little disappointed because I wanted to work something out as far as a debate or something like that up there. And then just a few days ago, somebody in channel, I think it was in channel, or maybe by email, one of the two ways, because it's one of our channel rats, contacted me and said, have you ever declined an invitation to debate Bob Enyart? Now, I knew the name. I've been up to Denver so many times that a lot of people had mentioned you two really ought to debate open theism. And it had come up sometime since 2005, because I remember riding in South Mountain Park and listening to something by Bob Enyart on the subject of open theism, but it was a number of years ago. So I responded and said, no, I've never declined an invitation to debate Bob Enyart. Why? Well, somebody's saying that you did. No. And so thought crossed my mind. I knew he was up in Denver, so I'm like, I want to see what you can arrange. Well, lo and behold, this is not normally how it's done, but in a very, very brief period of time, we have arranged for a debate Tuesday evening, July 8th. Don't have the time or location yet. They're working on that up there in the Denver area. But sometime Tuesday evening, July 8th. This is assuming that I don't fall off of the mountain in Santa Fe and I don't die on Mount Evans. Which I will have climbed at least once, maybe twice, prior to this. And no offense, Bob, but maybe at 14,000 feet, open theism will make sense. That is a great joke, and I went and used it now. I was thinking about waiting till Denver for that, that maybe the higher altitude you are. And now in Colorado, there's a lot of things you can do with Colorado highs. There really, really are.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, there you can do a lot of stuff up there, but
if it actually pans out that the track record of your opponents listening to your shows, he will never.
Oh no, no, I think in fact, when I mentioned it on my Facebook feed, he posted it to did something with his I don't know. He did something with it in Facebook.
The word is share.
Okay, maybe he did.
I know you want to retweet everything because yeah. everything surrounds, you know, Twitter, but, you know, Facebook, it's share.
Yeah.
That's, sharing.
That tells you a little bit about Facebook. But anyway, so no, I'm sure they're listening in, or if not right now, they will be. But anyhow, I'm sure he has a sense of humor. He does radio. He has to have a sense of humor. Because everybody in radio is insane. But anyhow, I say that as a person who used to work in radio a lot. so that's coming up on the 8th. So what I want to do is I want to start off and give you some idea. It has been 13 years. Was it 2001? Was 2001 the Sanders debate? That's the year I have in my mind, is 2001. I could be wrong about that. And I forgot to actually unarchive that, but it's in Dropbox anyways. But the last time I really seriously addressed the subject of open theism was when I debated John Sanders at Reformed Theological Seminary. And it's not that we haven't had some comment on it since then, but there have been a couple of people who have tried to get Greg Boyd to debate on that subject, but he doesn't seem interested in it. And so this will be the first time. So there have been some books that have come out since then, and I thank everybody who jumped on the ministry resource list today. I think I've put a couple other things, since there were people going, I wanted to help out, but by the time I get there, it's already taken care of. So there might still be some things up there. I don't know. Maybe you can tell me if it's already been taken care of. But so I put some stuff up on the ministry resource list, and obviously I've got many hours of writing over the next 2 weeks to do. There's one thing left on the ministry resource list right now. That's the more expensive book on homosexuality. No, really? That one went? It's the Kindle edition on hell. Okay. Yeah. Anyways, there's still at least one thing there that someone can grab if they really want to, which we appreciate very, very much. But so what I want to do is I want to give you some idea of where Bob Enyart's coming from, to give you some idea of what the debate's going to be about. It's very, very interesting to me. You say, well, how do you know? I mean, you're just now getting this material. Well, again, I listened to something a number of years ago, and then when I knew this was a possibility, they had called us yesterday because, you know, my person talked to their person, and then that person, whatever. So this morning, I did a fairly short ride, a 38-mile ride, and so I put a couple things for the program on, and I thought, let's see what I can grab from Bob Enyart. And so I grabbed this brief little thing where he was talking to a Church of Christ, I'm sorry, Calvary Chapel pastor up there in Denver. And so I want to play some portions of that to help you to understand. And it's interesting because the perspective that he's coming from is to emphasize, he even says that we want to approach this from a Trinitarian perspective. Interesting. And the emphasis, what you're going to hear is, well, we believe God is free to change the future and to write a new song. There's the perspective. God is free to change the future. And basically what he's saying is, if you believe that God knows the future, then God is stuck. The future takes on a life unto itself. And this, of course, is my primary response, is that it creates a view of time and God's knowledge of time that just does not represent what Orthodox Christianity has ever viewed. Now, obviously, my biggest objection to theism is it's plainly unbiblical. I mean, the Bible is clear in its teaching that God not only knows what is knowable in the future, as in his own actions, but it is just beyond question that God knows the actions of free human creatures. And so, obviously, I will be focused upon that. But the point is that in presenting it, what he does is he's basically saying, well, I'm defending the freedom of God. And I have a real problem with that, because I don't think that's what you're doing at all. First of all, I don't believe that my God is unfree, because his knowledge of the future is based upon what his own will accomplishes in the future in the first place. So what you're saying is God is free to do something less than the perfect will that expressed his decree, which created time in the first place. Okay. But, you know, these are things that it'll be up to me to be able to point these things out and say, I don't think this is an appropriate way of expressing this, because how is God free if his actions are circumscribed by human actions that he does not know? How can you say God is free when on September 10th, 2001, he knew what could possibly happen the next day, but he didn't know if it would happen the next day? He knew the plans in the hearts of men, but many of the plans in the hearts of man. I mean, Psalm 33 comes up once again. I think Psalm 33 is a pretty tough text for anyone to deal with who's a Molinist or an open theist or Arminian. And by the way, he criticizes Arminianism as well, at least Arminians who hold to a concept of exhausted divine foreknowledge. Not sure how they have a grounding for that, but that's another issue. So anyway, I wanted to play a little bit of this in the first half hour. Then in the second half hour, I'm going to be responding to William Michael. I'm assuming it's Weiss. I didn't ask him. I should have asked him. We were chatting on because it wasn't. I don't believe it was in the film as far as the pronunciation. I would say Weiss. It could be Wyss, I suppose, but Weiss is much more. Well, it's. I don't even know what the background of that is. It looks Eastern European. W-Y-S-S. That looks very Eastern European to me, where you use words, you use letters for vowels that, you know, yeah, no, not even German, no. I mean, William Michael sounds a little bit German, but we'll go with Weiss. Anyways, he was one of the students featured in the Just People video that was shot at Grand Canyon, which I found out yesterday was shot 2 years ago. Didn't know that. But we're going to respond to some of the things he had to say. And he has agreed that once I get back from Colorado, I guess he's still in the valley here between semesters. We have to figure out how to move that camera so it shoots over there, and he'll join me in studio. Well, as long as I'm nice today, I imagine. I will be, but I have to respond to some of the things he said. So hopefully that won't be too much of an issue. Then the last half hour, going to be responding to Nick Peters and on defining inerrancy, because remember, very briefly, I think it was on the last program or the program before that, I mentioned some stuff about the Lordship of Christ and the last chapter of defining inerrancy that really bothered me, and so he's responded, and so I'll respond again. So lots of interesting stuff on the program. And if I happen to get through all of that, believe it or not, I have a video that we might get to, but I don't have a lot of confidence we're going to do that. Let's listen briefly, because I'm not going to be doing much interacting here. But let's listen briefly to Bob starts off his program here. This is all the way back 7 years ago. Starts his program off complaining about what a local Calvary Chapel pastor said. Had a caller who asked him some things. Clearly they had been listening to Bob. And here's the clip that he didn't like.
I'll walk you through it.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me start you from the beginning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The person you were listening to on the radio today, never listen to them again.
Well, I turned it off.
Good for you.
That'd be me, Bob Inyard, Pastor Bob Inyard. Hey, come on, never listen again. Now
he says, this is rough. This is tough. Well, Bob, put yourself in my position. I'm a pastor, and this Calvary Chapel pastor is a pastor. And if you really believe, as I believe, that open theism is fundamentally anti-biblical, unbiblical, and that it has an incredible impact on how you and I would respond to tragedy, counseling, there's so many. I mean, that's why I've debated this in the past. I think it's important, just like you think it's important. Wouldn't you warn your sheep away from those who are teaching something you think is fundamentally erroneous? I'm not sure why you wouldn't take that perspective. And then he called into the program of that particular pastor, and the pastor knew who it was. And so here's some of that conversation.
That's cool. What can I do for you?
I heard the caller, you guys were talking about the future and whether the future is settled or open.
The open theistic argument, yes.
Right, exactly, that the future is open and that God, in fact, has the power, the ability to change the future. For example, that God, if he wants to, he could write a new song.
Okay, so there's obviously the Enyartian, is that a word? Well, we just made one up. The Enyartian formulation of open theism, that God can change the future and write a new song. Now, obviously, from my perspective, that's not the issue. Because what you're saying is God could invalidate his knowledge of the future and do something less perfect than he had decreed to do. Because his knowledge of the future flows from his decree to act in a particular way to bring himself maximal glory. And so what you're saying is God's knowledge of what God himself can be invalidated if God chooses to invalidate his knowledge of himself. So there's going to be some of the issues that we will be looking at. But hey, I'll give you props that's a really, let's put it this way, John Sanders didn't come up with a really nice sort of marketing approach to what open theism should be about.
John Sanders' approach was, you had 1,500 years to figure this out. We're still working on it.
Well, he did say that during the debate, didn't he? I sat there going, really? Really? Okay. There you go. We continue on.
That God is creative. That God could do something creative. God is the one who designed the Garden of Eden, right?
Sure.
And today, if God...
Now, again, God is creative. I agree. Does that... And his providence and his decree continues that creativity. And it's perfect creativity. And it's what he has intended to do from eternity past. So much of this argumentation is man-centered, looking upward at what God is doing. And once you have a God-centered perspective, it just doesn't flow.
God wants to. We talk about the future, and we say it's comforting to think that the future is totally settled, but God exists also. And so God, he has the ability.
Now notice how the future is something that exists outside of God here in this mindset. And it's not. The future is settled because God has a decree that represents his creativity and his freedom and his self-glorification, and therefore it flows from his being. It's not something that exists outside and constrains God's freedom. It's the expression of God's freedom. God was free to do exactly what was perfect according to his own will. And this is, you know, and I'm being consistent here. Has this not been my criticism of Molinism as well? That the Molinist looks out and goes, well, the extent of God's freedom was limited by the true counterfactuals of human freedom to these particular feasible worlds. What I'm saying is, the only people that allow God to actually be God and to be free in totality, I think it's us Calvinists. I really do. And I'll defend that. Tuesday, July 8th. You live in Denver, Evergreen, Boulder, my friends at Flatirons, Eric Ellis and the guys, hope you can make it down that night once we know where we're going.
And the power to do new things. So I don't think it's heresy to say that God is a creative God, that he still is creative, and that he could write a new song, he could do a new thing.
Well, it all depends on what direction you go, Bob.
Yeah.
If you come from the direction of not the creative power of God, but the lack of knowledge from God, that he lacks knowledge that he's yet to gain, and he waits for our activity to gain that knowledge.
Now here, again, what is the open theist saying? Remember what Sanders said in our debate. He admitted God had, when God created, he had no idea you were going to exist. Because if he does not know the actions of free human creatures, then how could he know any one of us would ever exist? Because we are the result of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of decisions by free human creatures. So there's no way he could know that you as an individual would exist. Not possible. Not possible. So that means God learns. God's learning new things. God learned things on September 11th. God learned things on July 7th in the UK. He knew the possibilities, but even then, he hadn't known those possibilities from eternity. That's the only way to safeguard absolute libertarian freedom, which, again, I say only God has. We have creaturely freedom. We do not have libertarian freedom. Nowhere does the Bible say so. The Bible actually contradicts that concept over and over and over and over and over again. The only way you can defend that is by saying, well, if this, 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 then this, and have to just ignore the plain passages, no man is able, no man is able. Straightforward.
Which is the more popular open theistic argument?
Well, I hold the very popular open theist position, but forget about mankind for a moment. Think about just God. From eternity past.
Okay, so this is where he's saying, let's not go talk about man and freedom. Let's just talk about the Trinity, which, you know, could be interesting. At least it'll be different than the Sanders debate, to be sure.
God is creative. It's not that the future was always settled. God decided to create. He decided how he would design a monarch butterfly. He decided to save us.
Well, let's pause there for a second, Bob.
Yeah.
He decided to create the monarch butterfly. Could he then decide to make the monarch butterfly something different, or is that fixed?
If God wanted to, he could design another kind of butterfly for the new Earth.
No, I agree.
And at this point, I'm not sure that we're really focusing on what's really important, because the issue with open theism is not design issues. It is the interaction of God with his creatures. If God had chosen to use a monarch butterfly to change the course of a battle and hence change the entire course of Western civilization, that's the issue. And having decided that, could he then undecide to do that? Or could he have wanted to use a monarch butterfly to accomplish something, and because of the human decision... Just the thought just crossed my mind. But sometime over the weekend when I was riding in Flagstaff, I was climbing Snowball Road, which you don't climb very fast. It's steep, it's long, it's high altitude. And at one point I'm going along and I see this beetle type. It wasn't one of those really ugly ones with the big old legs. This type of beetle type thing in front of me. And I had just a split second to decide, am I going to even put out the effort to get around this thing rather than run over it? Okay? Split second. I mean, because you just happen to notice it moves a little bit, you see it, and, you know, your mind does the I'm going to be rolling right there thing, and you, split second. What? 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 Great. So you have this split second type thing. So what I decided to do, if I recall correctly, was to avoid it. Well, what if God had chosen to use that particular bug? That's a bug instead of the monarch butterfly. Maybe it was there were some caterpillars out. And of course, butterflies come from caterpillars and so on and so forth. And so, what if my choice, that split-second choice, which God cannot know. What if I was just too tired, and I ran the thing over? Now there's not going to be the butterfly to do the thing God wants to do, to change the entire course of the world. So now he's got to change everything. See? That's really where the issue is.
But in
the
space and time continuum that we live in today,
yeah.
Will the monarch butterfly always be a monarch butterfly, or would God speak from heaven and change?
I imagine it will always be. But when he creates a new heaven and a new earth,
sure.
he's still the creative God.
Sure.
It's not as though the future is utterly settled and he's trapped because he's creative.
No, I would agree. I would fully agree with you.
Okay, so then let me ask you. Let's say God decides to write a new song. God has the ability to affect the future. Like our prayers, the Bible teaches that our prayers can touch the heart of God.
Okay, this brings us to the whole prayer issue. I don't have time to get into it today. I've got two more topics to get to, and I'm already down to 5 minutes here. But obviously, the issue of prayer, extremely important. I'm sure that's going to come up, as did issues relating to, obviously, there are only a couple texts that open theists generally tend to focus upon, but Abraham sacrifice and Now I Know and that kind of material, though. We'll get into those. But especially the issue of prayer. And what is interesting at this point is obviously Bob's response to Calvinists is going to be different than Bob's response to Arminians at this point, because the perspective being presented by the Calvinists could be very different than that of the Arminian, especially in regards to the actual relationship between the will of God and the will of man. And the Arminian has just a completely different viewpoint on that. It is interesting that according to what I heard here, a 250-page debate with a professor from Knox that, of course, I'll turn into MP3. I'll listen to that, too. But I didn't see any debates with an Arminian on the subject. Now, obviously, the Calvary Chapel guy, who knows, but most Calvary Chapel guys are not exactly Reformed. But that's, you know, this touches on all of these things. That's why I say it really does impact so much of our beliefs as to what we believe God's knowledge involves.
And could even move his hands.
Well, before we get to prayers, let's talk about this. Would it be possible for God to write new theology?
Well, theology is a statement of reality. So,
and at this point, I would go, what about prophecy? What about, when God says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z through Cyrus, does he have the freedom to not do X, Y, and Z through Cyrus by writing a new song? That's where I would see a little bit better questions might have been asked, a little more focused questions might have been asked at that point.
God's not going to change the truth.
True.
Right? When Jesus Christ, when he suffered for us, like he did, that was a change, right? Many Christians are taught that God is utterly immutable.
That was a change. I don't know what that means. Was the incarnation a change in the actual divine being? If that's what's being said, I'd have a serious problem with that.
That he can't change in any way? But God the Father loved us so much that he sent his Son to die on the cross for us. And Jesus Christ suffered for us. He became sin. He became a curse for us, as Paul writes. And so that was different. God the Father had never before poured out his wrath on the Son. And Paul...
Now what you got here, again, it's backwards from a biblical perspective. It's from the bottom looking up. The Bible gives us a perspective to see this and not end up causing all the contradiction that open theism causes in the Bible, because what we see is not that God has changed. This is simply God's free choice to interact with his people in time. But it's a choice that he made from eternity past. So anyways, the point is, what you're hearing here is standard enunciation of an open theistic perspective. I think it has tremendous impact. There is a later call. I won't be able to get to it. Let me just summarize it real quickly, because we're gonna run out of time here, because I do need to get the other ones as well. There was a call later on where Bob talked to a woman who asked about a text in Ezekiel, something about where God knows our thoughts. And basically what Bob said was, well, he knows our thoughts, not that he will know our thoughts 5 billion years from now. And I felt, first of all, that's not really dealing with the text real well, because the point of the Ezekiel text was that God always knows our thoughts because he knows us completely. He knows the words before they're on our lips. And while I wouldn't try to push that specifically to prove that God knows all future events, I think that's found in Isaiah, that's found in Ephesians 1, etc., etc. The point was that there was a fundamental distinction between the view of God, which he will not affirm that he is omniscient. He would affirm that God learns. And historical Christian orthodoxy, which wasn't just simply created by speculation by a bunch of people that were influenced by Greek philosophy. There are fundamental issues of God's knowledge, his activity, his sovereignty, his purposes, prophecy, the very means by which God demonstrates he's God. The very tests he gives us, but whereby we can test who is the true God. Fundamental to that is God's absolute knowledge of future events. That's the whole trial of the false gods, Isaiah 40-48. I don't believe an open theist can walk through those texts and survive, at least not in a cross-examination situation. So it's going to be interesting, but once again, it's been so long since we've actually dealt with it that some of you might have been going, what in the world is open theism? Well, that's going to be coming up. Still coming up, Rich? Okay, good.
Yes, quick update. That was Bob Enya calling, and there I kind of thought maybe he was listening and wanted to chime in. No, they're up there feverishly looking for a venue, and he's apparently
They have a place?
I'm not sure what they're trying to work in here. He apparently are working on a Calvary Chapel up there, and thought that you know, the Calvary Chapel guys aren't necessarily his biggest fans, kind of the way he
and they're certainly not mine either.
And he thought maybe a call from us might help. And I'm like, no, I don't think it will. I don't think it will at all.
No, well.
Let's keep looking.
Yeah, let me say, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sitting there remembering a particular reaction you got from Hank Hanegraaff when you pointed out that George Bryson's position logically worked into open theism, and they were not happy about that at all.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway. So it's going to be an interesting debate. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's important, and so there's the first half hour. Okay, do you have video? You do have the video all ready to go over there, right? Okay, good. Let's move on from there, and let's transition. For those of you who did not see it last week, I think most of you did. We responded to a video that was, now I know, produced 2 years ago and was sat on for 2 years regarding homosexuality at Grand Canyon University. Grand Canyon University is a Christian university here in Phoenix. It's my alma mater. I was at Grand Canyon when it was Grand Canyon College, a Southern Baptist school, from fall of 1981 until I graduated in 1985. I was a double major in Bible and biology, single minor in Greek. And so I am an alumnus. I taught there. As soon as I graduated from Fuller Seminary, I was asked to teach church history at Grand Canyon, starting in 1991. Well, so not immediately. It was 2 years later. And then a couple years after that, Dr. Bill Williams, who had been the president when I first went there, he gave me a presidential scholarship when I graduated from high school. He made me scholar in residence at Grand Canyon, 95, 96, 97, I believe is when I did that. And so I was teaching church history again and apologetics and a few things there at Canyon during that time. Around 2000, Canyon disassociated from Southern Baptist Convention. And things started going south. Around 2004, it looked like Canyon was going to close. They were deeply in debt, and things weren't going well. Today, Grand Canyon is one of the fastest growing universities in America. Amazing. Absolutely. I had no idea. I mean, I had driven by the campus, saw all the new buildings, They are putting buildings up, multi-story buildings up, at a pace you would not believe. And their plan is to have 30,000 students on campus in the not-too-distant future. They are providing affordable education, especially in science, engineering, nursing, all sorts of stuff. It's an amazing story. So, obviously, given that it's a Christian university, there is a statement of faith. There is obviously a moral standard that is affirmed by the leadership of the university. To have a student-produced video that talks about homosexuality online is an issue. We reviewed it last week, or the week before, somewhere around there, and responded to, I felt, the most important stuff. One of the things that I had skipped was the discussion, well, I mentioned it, but I didn't spend much time on it, was a discussion that seems to be a very common thing, where there was a discussion of someone persecuting, threatening one of the homosexual students. One of the things that really bugs me is I've discovered since then, discovered only yesterday, in fact, that they didn't tell the whole story. And by not telling the whole story, it was deeply dishonest. Deeply dishonest. Because what they didn't bother to say, though they knew, they had to have known this information, is that the leadership of Grand Canyon found out about this that very same day and dealt with it immediately. And while all those students continued at Grand Canyon, the student responsible did not. Now, that changes everything. That changes everything. To all of my homosexual friends, this victim mentality thing does not serve your cause very well. It does not. How many times now have we... Remember the two lesbians in, what was it, Washington State someplace, talked about the... the spray painting of nasty stuff on there a year ago? I was told 2 years ago.
So, yeah. The caller is challenging your source. He said it was made, it sounds like the caller was part of the video.
I can't hear you?
It sounds like the caller is part of the video. He's
okay.
Saying that it was made a year ago. So.
Well, I was told yesterday it was 2 years ago. So I've got contradictory information.
Yeah, and I let him know that.
Okay. This whole victim thing, the lesbians that said that they sprayed paint on their house and stuff like that, and then turned out that they did it themselves. That does not help anybody. And if you all knew what the fact that this was dealt with and didn't include that, bad stuff. What was it they said in Peter Pan? Bad form. You just don't do that. I'm sorry. This was one-sided. This was badly one-sided enough to then have that. Anyway, the point being that the only person I've heard from is William, and that was on Facebook. Now, most of you know, I've been trying to do more on Facebook, but I still think it was an interface designed by someone in 1996. I really do. And I don't like the interface, and I do not get the messages or things like that or friend requests and stuff like that. Rich is the one who wants me on Facebook, so he said, I'll deal with all that. Because between the icky stuff that I don't like about the interface, and then when I did try it a while back, I started getting flooded with all this stuff. And for a while, I was trying to deal with my own friend requests and stuff. And I would literally just be sitting there, clicking. Oh. And I finally, just one day, I said, forget it. Don't want it. just get rid of it. And so I don't get that message stuff and all the rest of that stuff. So William had actually posted a comment in that thread. I think it was the 19th or 18th. I think it was like 4 or 5 days ago. I didn't see it. And in fact, Rich had to point it out to me. Because he hadn't seen it either. And so I wanted to respond to that, but I wanted to play just what had started all of this from the video itself. So here's the clip that if I'm correct, this my comments in response to this is what got William to respond to me.
Dumb that we get so caught up in it, because I think I'll start this by saying that I think God is so much less concerned about homosexual or heterosexual or pansexual, whatever sexual you want to be. I think God's so less concerned with that rather than just getting to know the actual people and being in relationships with them. If I could use an example, it's almost like doing math. Like, no man is ever going to start with math, this giant broad scope of the subject with friggin' calculus or trigonometry. No, we don't do that in elementary school either. We don't go to the big giant stuff. We start with 2 plus 2 and 4 times 1. We do subtraction and addition long before we ever touch the big stuff. And I think the same is true with faith. Before you can ever argue theologically or semantically about the versions of the Bible and translations and the different rights and wrongs, you have to get the basics down first. And the biggest basic of it all is that Jesus loves you so much. And that's anyone. That is anyone who wants to be in a relationship with you. The Bible is not just...
Okay, so my response to that, there was a lot of stuff there. And my response to that was, I don't see any evidence that William has listened to the other side, that he has really got a grounding for saying the things. And when you start off saying, it's so dumb, and I made some comments about that last time around. Well, he seemed to be offended by that. And so he wrote a comment, which I did not see until last evening. And here's what it said. I want to respond to some things. You know, I started to write a list of things I wanted to comment on, but I don't think that would be very wise of me to have that conversation here. I think your decision to try and carry out a conversation about touchy subjects like homosexuality and faith on Facebook is plain immature. I did this on the web. And this is just part of an ongoing discussion that I've been trying to have with a lot of people for a long time, William. This has included debating non-homosexual representatives of liberal Christianity, Bishop John Shelby Spong, Barry Lynn, debating homosexuals like Justin Lee, and what's the other guy's name you keep telling me? Bradshaw. Yeah, D. Bradshaw. He was with the Metropolitan Church, if I recall correctly. Metropolitan Church up in Salt Lake, yeah. Trying to get Matthew Vines to debate. Not accomplishing much there. excuse me, William. You're not nearly as interesting as my granddaughter, my daughter just tweeted a picture. Yep, she's sticking her finger right in my face. On the screen, and then immediately finds water, and that's much more interesting than anything else I have to say. So I'm retweeting that to my followers. Sorry about that. Very, very important. And I am currently baby. Everyone's baby. But I guess I think it's because I don't have any hair. I think that's why she's got that connection going. I bet you if I wore a wig, she'd stop calling me baby, but I'm not going to do that. Anyway, back to the subject here. I wasn't trying to have a conversation on Facebook, but I have the conversation wherever the conversation is available. I've written an entire book on this subject, well, co-authored an entire book on this subject, and have done a fair amount of work on this subject over the years, so I don't know where you get off saying it's plain immature of me to be trying to carry out a conversation about this on Facebook. I don't get it. Only considering that sitting down with me and talking about this like men would probably be immensely better and far more productive for us both. I have zero interest in having debate over Facebook comments. Yes, I am calling you out to have a conversation with me in person. I will say this, though. Yes, I'm contradicting myself. Well, I'm glad that you saw that you're contradicting yourself. I said young men of this age need to have mentors and people they can look up to that can instruct them in theology, and unfortunately, there's no evidence that he's had that happen. And your comments, William, said that. You had the idea that, you know, you don't start off with calculus, and before you can talk about Bible versions, you got to get this basic stuff down. Well, that sounds really good, but I don't think you could actually make that work. How do you get the basic stuff down about what God's will for your life is if you don't know that God's spoken? I don't even know what you're talking about Bible translations. What do you mean? Are you talking about controversies over the translation of Arsene Coites? We can engage in a discussion of Arsene Coites. I don't think there's any question about it at all. You go back to the Greek Septuagint, it's as plain as the nose on your face, but that's not the kind of stuff that you're going to be reading in the pro-homosexual books, which very rarely interact with the other side. One thing is absolutely certain, William, is that if you look at Michael Brown, if you look at my work, listen to our debates, we interact with the other side. We read Brownston. We read Boswell. We read Countryman, Scanzoni, Mullencott, Lee, Vines. We read them all. I've got one of the best libraries around of homosexual works, presenting the quote-unquote Christian view on that from a homosexual perspective. Don't see it from the other side. Well, yeah, that Gagnon guy's written something. Here's a footnote. That's it. That's it. I mean, Brownson, at least, who's not a homosexual, Brownson had to interact with Gagnon, but that's about it. That's about it. And I can back that up with lots of evidence. Lots of evidence. Not only, here's William's comment, not only is that an insult, it's self-righteous. Where do you get off? You have zero right, and I mean zero right, to make that sort of judgment call based upon 2 minutes of footage of me speaking. If what you said could be easily taken apart by someone who has been dealing with the subject longer than you have been alive, William, then I have a strong foundation for saying that. If I could not look in the mirror and say, have I honestly done the work to listen to the other side over and over and over again? And William, honestly, ask yourself a question. Have you watched my debate with Justin Lee? With any of these guys? If you haven't, then you're the one in the situation of not really having a right to say what you're saying. Which, mind you, is me and my best novice, yes, novice attempts to try and reconcile people back to a God that loves them. Biblical term. It's something that Christ does. We are ministers of reconciliation, William, only as we proclaim the work of Christ. And as I said in my response, this is a gospel issue. I honestly believe, and can, I believe, demonstrate biblically that the position you are adopting fundamentally vitiates, ends our ability to define the very reason for the gospel in the first place. And that's why it's so important. That's why I spend the time talking about these things. That's why I'm willing to have you sit right down over there when I get back from Colorado, and we'll have a chat about it. But you may feel that you're trying to reconcile people back to God, but let's talk about what's actually happening in the message that you're delivering. From a biblical perspective, from the world's perspective, you get to define what reconcile means. You don't have to worry about it. From a Christian perspective, only the scriptures define what reconcile. Only the scriptures define what the gospel is. And so something tells me we'll have to have some discussions about what ultimate authority is for a Christian. Because fundamentally, I've never seen a person who promotes homosexuality as an acceptable Christian behavior and lifestyle that can maintain a high view of Scripture. We see it happening with Matthew Vines right now. We see it happening. You have to undercut the supremacy and sufficiency of Scripture to be able to come up with that. You seem to be in the business of making arguments and fights, creating a dividing line, and maybe I don't have a doctorate in this stuff, but I do see a consistent theme in the New Testament where us as believers are being called to unity. Do you believe in that at all? Good question. I believe in the unity that the Bible teaches, which is a unity of truth. I mean, what is the key text in the New Testament on the subject of the unity of Christians? John chapter 17, Jesus' high priestly prayer. They may all be one as we are one. And how are we one? We are one by being sanctified in the truth. Thy word is truth. So what makes us one is not sameness of thought. It is the work of the Spirit of God within us, which makes us obedient to the truth of God. And that truth has been revealed to us in the person, life, ministry of Jesus Christ, who is the Word of God, and in the inspired Scriptures, which testify to us of what of who He was and what He did. And so, the only true unity is a unity that's based upon what God has revealed about Himself. Do you have unity with Mormons? Well, let's take a step back. Do you have unity, William, with Muslims? They claim to believe in Jesus. They claim to be in the religion, the second largest religion in the world that teaches people to love Jesus. Do you have unity with them? How? They deny that Jesus is the Son of God. They deny the crucifixion. They deny the resurrection. They deny the centrality of Christ. No, we don't have unity with Muslims. As much as we may love them, as much as we may care for them and pray for them, we can't have unity with them because the only unity that is meaningful is a unity that is based upon a common confession of truth that is true for each generation, that is true in every generation and in every culture. So no, we don't have unity with the Muslim. We evangelize the Muslim. How about the Mormon? Most people in the world today call Mormonism Christianity, right? It's Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints. Who are we to judge? I mean, I just must be a real self-righteous person, right? And yet, in many ways, Islam is much closer to Christianity than Mormonism ever could be. Can you have unity with a person who believes that God was a man living on another planet? And that he had a God before him? And that there is an unlimited number of gods in the universe? And that Jesus is the spirit brother of Lucifer? And can you really have unity with someone like that? How can we be sanctified in the truth as Jesus prayed, which is the foundation of our unity, if you don't have a dividing line? How can you do that? And so I really, and this is the background of what I said, which you found to be so insulting. I don't see in your comments clarity of thought in regards to the nature, if you want to use the big terms, of Christian epistemology. Your Christian worldview is not well formed. It is not consistent, and it's not biblical. You say that's offensive. For a Christian, it can only be offensive if it's untrue. If what I'm saying is true, it shouldn't be offensive, right? That's the issue. So you say, believers are being called unity. Do you believe in that at all? Yes, a unity of truth. And that is why I emphasize so strongly, and anybody who knows me, you can ask. I emphasize so strongly sola scriptura, tota scriptura, and the consistency of the Christian worldview. God is not honored by muddled thinking that is inconsistent. Now, if that's offensive, then I would say to you, it's only offending your worldly sensibilities. But it would never be offensive to a Christian. It would never be offensive to a Christian. Think about that. Think about that. So, there you go. My hope is, since William says he's here in the local area, and he insists this was just a year ago, okay, then the evidence I was given, the information I was given was a little off, but a year ago, let's get together. sometime after I get back from Colorado. Those thunderclouds will be for me. The humidity will be up, and it'll be that time when we really wish we weren't in Phoenix. But we'll get together, and we'll have a discussion of these things right here. I'm not sure what we're going to do with this monitor. I guess I'd be able to see it. This is going to be a little bit weird. We'll figure it out. We'll probably use this camera. We'll have two different camera shots, the whole nine yards. We'll make it work. Yes, I know. Isn't that beautiful? Look at that. She is looking. Look at that hair. I mean, that is getting long. That is really getting long. And she said that's baby. Yeah, so I'm baby. And then Will Hoffman just put something on the family TV in HD. That's scary when I'm looking right into the camera like that with my glowing head. That's frightening. That really, really is. Thanks, Will. Notice I'm wearing my triple bypass. That has nothing to do with my heart. that's the bike ride. And I don't mind telling people I'm going to be in the triple bypass. Actually, the double triple bypass. Because there are so many people in the double triple bypass. There are so many thousands. What? There are so many thousands of people that when we all put our helmets on, we put our sunglasses on, we put our cotton spandex shorts on, we all look the same. So I normally don't tell people about where I'm going to be riding and stuff like that. But, yeah, I'm doing the triple bypass bike ride. The double triple. Both days. 240 miles, 21,000 feet of climbing at altitude. And, yeah. Should I tell people? Well, And I also told the next guy that I'm going to be responding to him, too. So I need to stick to my word. I'll be happy to talk to him afterwards if he wants to do that. But I need to be fair. I had even written to and contacted Nick Peters and said I'm going to, and it's not an easy topic, as he will see. So we will plan on it. And unless there's something there about not being able to do that, then I need to move on to the next topic. So, okay. Third topic. Tough topic. Okay, look. I'm a little frustrated with this one. I'll be honest with you. And Max, I'm sorry. I've actually started an Evernote list of all the things that I said I'm going to get to. I wanted to get to more of Max Andrews' book. I'll get to it in time. I don't know what we're going to be doing next week. We're thinking about, and John, we haven't even contacted John Sampson yet, but we're going to contact him and see if he's available, because we started looking at the stuff. I just don't know how I'm going to be able to do anything next week. And we're going to be doing it early on Wednesday, early tomorrow morning, right? Right. Tomorrow morning is when we're doing the program? 10 a.m.? And I'm making you multitask. 10 a.m.? 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. 10 a.m. Wednesday morning is when we're going to do the program. If he insists, maybe, can he call tomorrow morning? Find out if that's a possibility, because I don't have anything necessarily lined up, so we can fit William in then if you want. Anyways, Reggie Turner says, we love you, Mr. Clean. I do look like Mr. Clean right now, don't I? Except he was big and bulky, and I'm not big and bulky. I'm training hard for a massive bike ride. So we're anyway. Shifting gears. A response: James White on defining inerrancy. Nick Peters. What I did on the last program or a couple programs ago. That's good for tomorrow. Okay. What I did. Is I just mentioned in passing. This was not. They even say that I reviewed the book. No, I didn't. I made a few comments on the program in passing. I said, I listened to this book. Here's a couple things I liked about it. Here's a couple things I didn't like about it. But this was the one. The whole reason that I even brought it up. Honestly, if the book had ended before Nick Peters' chapter, I didn't know that Nick Peters wrote it. I, like I said, had to go home and find out who had. If the book had ended prior to the chapter on the Lordship of Christ, doing scholarship on the Lordship of Christ, I never would have mentioned it, probably, unless someone had called up. Because while I found it interesting, and while I did not agree with a number of the things it said, and while, as I said, my biggest problem with it was it simplified the issue too much. You've got your contextualizers, and you've got your traditionalists. No, you don't. You got a whole spectrum. Got a whole spectrum. I find myself agreeing more with the conservatives, and I didn't say this before, but I will now. If you want some more criticism of the book, guys, lose the academic hubris over and over again. Well, Al Mohler really can't talk about this because his doctorate's in systematic theology, historical. You have to be a New Testament scholar to even discuss this stuff. Oh, please! I this is so offensive. It was so offensive. I mean, and Nick, you might, careful, I've got a pretty close relationship with a certain school, too. So, anyway, I found that really turned me off to the book Defining Inerrancy, was, well, we don't really need to worry what Al Mohler has to say, or what there's your seminary president, and blah, 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 and I was just like, seriously? This is a theological issue. And if you New Testament guys can't see the need for the systematic theologians and vice versa, no thanks. But anyways, I would have pretty much just, you know, that might have come up at some point. Maybe it's because it's the last chapter in the book. But I was really caught by what Nick Peters said. Now, let me refresh everyone's memory, because it was toward the end of the program. You might have forgotten about it. The authors, Holding and Peters, are pretty merciless to Norman Geisler. And for a lot of the reasons that all of us would understand, Norman Geisler has become the curmudgeon of Christian apologetics. And as he's gotten older, he's said and done a lot of things that just make you go, huh? And look, there's nobody he's been a whole lot more nasty to than me. I mean, seriously. I can tell you stories. I've told the story on the Dividing Line. I mean, anybody who owes Norman Geisler anything is not going to touch me with a 10-foot pole. All because of the Potter's Freedom. And now the Cantor situation. But to be honest with you, the Cantor situation is because of the Potter's Freedom, not the other way around. It's not because he had just such a, oh, I just love Erskine Cantor. He came to Cantor's defense because of his detestation of me because of the Potter's Freedom, which he's never read. What he detests most of the Potter's Freedom were the 27 endorsements on it. That's what has made him outrageously angry for a long time now. Okay. So, if anyone has reason to go after Norm Geisler, it would be me. But I have not made that the issue. And in this situation, Nick, I still think you're not hearing what Norm Geisler said. Geisler, and I'm reading from the book now, Geisler says further, this is at location 1653 of 1703. Gotta love the Kindle edition here. As evangelicals, we must beware of desiring a seat at the table of contemporary scholarship, which is riddled with presuppositions that are antagonistic to evangelical Christianity. Now, that's what Geisler said. And I agree with him. I don't think, Nick, reading your response, that you understand what Geisler was saying there, or you're not hearing him. Here's what you said in the book. On the contrary, I think we should eagerly be desiring this. How are we supposed to make an impact in the world of scholarship if we don't want to sit at the table? Imagine what it could mean for Christianity if Christians were seen as trusted authorities in each field instead of fearing antagonistic presuppositions. What happened to correcting them with real scholarship? Time out. Presuppositions are what give rise to the scholarship. That's the point. And your rejection of presuppositionalism, as you say, you say in your response, I'm not a presuppositionalist. Well, that comes out really clearly right here, because I think that's where you missed my point and Geisler's point. Says, C.S. Lewis once talked about what it would mean if Christians were so up on their game in the world of ideas that whenever an unbeliever got a textbook for a class that was written by the best in the field, that person was a Christian. This isn't just in the area of religion. What if the best astronomer was a Christian? What if the best heart surgeon was? What if the best psychologist was? What if the best lawyer was? Utterly irrelevant to what he was saying. You've missed it. I'm sorry, you've missed it. The issue is the presuppositions that modern non-Christian scholarship demand we embrace, which includes the denial of the lordship of Jesus Christ and the supremacy of Christian epistemology in any scholarship we do. We make a radical claim, Nick, that Jesus Christ created all things, and therefore every fact that is a fact because Jesus made it that way. And the world says you cannot start there. And the Christian has to say, I must start there. And you must start there if you want to have true knowledge. It has nothing to do with this. You can be the greatest heart surgeon in the world, but you do so under the lordship of Christ. And you do so openly proclaiming that. And the world says, you can't do that. And to sit at our table, we will not allow you. That's why I don't want to be at their table. I want to tell them their table has no legs on it. Their table is floating in midair. They're living in self-contradiction. I don't have any problem doing that. That's what presuppositional apologetics is all about. If we run from interaction with scholars, then who is going to be the influence on them? I'm not talking about running from interaction with scholars. I'm talking about refusing to accept their denial of the primary presuppositions of Christian epistemology. So to even say, if we run from interaction, this is what bothered me. That's not even what Geisler was saying to do. That's not what I'm saying to do. If we run from interaction with scholars, then who is going to be an influence on them? Are we going to wind up saying that Christianity has nothing to offer in the marketplace of ideas, that it cannot compete with when contemporary scholarship shows up? Or are we just saying Christianity should be afraid of scholarship? Irrelevant. Missed the point by a football field. Total football field miss here. Facepalm. In saying all of this, I do not think any contextualizing scholar holds the position they do because they want to simply be recognized at the table. Quite the contrary. I wish that were true. I wish that were true. I've seen it. I've told a story about being at the 1998 ETS conference and how offended I was by just that attitude, just that mindset. I'm glad you haven't seen it, Nick. I have. I have. I think they hold the position they do. And again, this quote-unquote contextualizing scholars, way too broad. I don't see it as a useful moniker. I think they hold the position they do because that is where the evidence leads, and that is what we want in scholarship. Evidence must be interpreted within a framework of epistemology. That's what this is all about. Now, I'm undoubtedly going beyond Geisler. I mean, I know what he was saying in his context, but he's not even consistent here because he hates presuppositions. I mean, the one thing we really, really, really say about Norm Geisler. Norm Geisler isn't overly consistent on these things. We want scholars, listen to this, who will approach the data as fairly and objectively as they can towards the goal of reaching the most truthful conclusions. We often say we want atheists, agnostics, and others to put aside their presuppositions and study Christianity, so shouldn't Christians do the same? No! No, 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 no. I don't know how many times... This is the whole point. This is a capitulation to the concept that there's a neutral possibility in epistemology. That was my problem. So, time's running out. Let me get to what he said in his response. He says, I was not surprised to hear it. The review was not a positive one, but at the same time, it is good to have press anyway. Well, again, it wasn't a review of the whole book. It was a review of this one particular chapter. In White's review, he wanted to save most of what he had to say for the final chapter, which happened to be written by me, as I explained, because that seemed to go sort of out of its way. It struck me as being a little different than the rest of the book, but anyway. When told about it, I was told, well, he certainly got your viewpoint wrong. Those who I shared it with, who I consider mentors, all were saying the same thing. No names are given, and no specifics are given, unfortunately. That's not the way to do it. It's important to point out, I mean, I've said you missed it, and I've given you really good reasons why I say you missed it. If you're going to say I missed it, then give me the reasons why. You say, well, I do later on. Well, let's find out. It's important to point out that White does say he agrees with Geis on the interpretation of Matthew 27. It should be pointed out that so does my co-author. Irrelevant. Didn't really bring it up. I mean, I mentioned it passing, but it's irrelevant to my criticism of what was said in regards to what it means to exercise scholarship under the Lordship of Christ. This is irrelevant. Okay. So then he gets to the Lordship over scholarship stuff. And White then wants you to hear my response, then quotes the response. White says that paragraph really concerns him and is muddled in an amazing way. Not a shock that White hones in on presuppositionalism. Yeah. Not only presuppositionalism as an apologetic issue, but presuppositionalism as the issue that Norman Geisler was talking about, because that's what you were taking issue with, and I still feel, at this point, you totally missed that. Now, I am not a presuppositionalist at all. But it does not mean that recognizing presuppositions played no role whatsoever in my thinking. White thinks that to sit at the table of scholarship is to compromise and give in to the presuppositions and to say there is a moral neutral ground. Not just a moral neutral ground, an epistemological neutral ground. That there is a fact that is a fact that Jesus didn't make a fact. And no, as a Christian, I can't go there. I have to challenge that from the beginning. Fear the Lord, the beginning of wisdom, the beginning of knowledge. This is basic Christian epistemology, which I realize a lot of evangelicals compromise on in a big, big, big way. It's a theological issue. But the point again is the quote from Geisler actually said exactly that. I mean, that's exactly what he said. As evangelicals, we must be aware of desiring a seat at the table of contemporary scholarship. And then here's the quote. He wasn't saying we should not engage with them. He's saying, which is riddled with presuppositions that are antagonistic to evangelical Christianity. That was the context. You know, if you want to change the context, then change the context. But that's what I was dealing with, because that's what's actually in the text. I was going to say on the page. But can you say on the page anymore with Kindle? I'm really not sure. I guess you can. It's on the same location, on the screen, something like that. He also says that it is saying we should lay aside our commitment to the absolute lordship of Christ and to the radical elements of that. What I'm saying is that our commitment to the absolute lordship of Christ and the radical elements of that claim is so basic and so foundational that worldly scholarship, which denies these things, rebellious scholarship, which places man at the center of epistemology and places God outside as an object of knowledge, will never let us sit at that table. Every chair at the table, Nick, is marked with Jesus is not Lord. I ain't sitting in that table. I ain't sitting on that chair. I can't. Does that mean I can't interact with these people? No, of course not. I'm not running from them. I'm challenging them. I'm not going to sit there at the table and say, let's just all talk about what we have in common. They're rebels. I have to deal with those issues first. I realize that's not the general Biola approach, but that's why I criticize that. He goes on to say, White tells us that Geisler recognized that sitting at the table of scholarship is doing that, and then adds, but I don't know where Nick Peters is coming from. Then he says, and this has really bugged me, at this point it would have been better off if he didn't know where I'm coming from to try to contact me. I'm not hard to find. My blog is there. My own podcast is there. All of them are ways to contact me. If he has no idea where I'm coming from, all that needed to be done was to ask. Instead, White will proceed to talk about a position, assuming that is mine, even though, by his own words, he does not know where I am coming from. What I meant, I think fairly obviously, Nick, is not that I was claiming to be an expert in everything you've ever written or done. I'm not. But The context was, in your own book, in your own words, I find incoherence. I find contradiction. And so it's easy to say, I don't know where he's coming from because this doesn't make sense. I wasn't saying, well, I have no idea, but I'm just going to just make a bunch of comments here anyways. Come on, Nick. Really? Seriously? I mean, you're the one that put it in writing. And if you didn't express it clearly enough and you want to make a bunch of modifications, stuff like that, that's your fault. And you know what? I don't have any problem saying that because I'll live with that because I write too. And I will, you know, if someone says, you know, this paragraph that you wrote misled me, then I'm going to ask them, you know, show me where in all the stuff that I have quoted just today, I'm misrepresenting you or don't understand what you're saying. I do understand what you're saying. I just don't find it consistent. Find incoherent. I don't see how it's biblical. So that's what I meant when I said, I don't know where you're coming from here, because I find incoherence. I think most people found that. I think they recognize that. I don't think it was really fair to take that kind of a shot. So White says he hopes I'm saying that we should be seeking to challenge those presuppositions, but that wasn't what Geisler was talking about. It's a shame White didn't go with his first inclination of what he hoped I was saying. What he hopes I'm saying is, in fact, what I'm really saying in that chapter. White repeats my saying, how are we supposed to have an impact if we don't sit at the table? White suggests that we do so by showing that the presuppositions that they accept are, in fact, incoherent and by critiquing their worldview. Now, I would not do it in a presuppositional way, but I would, in fact, challenge them. But the point is, Nick, to sit at the table requires you to fundamentally surrender the only ground upon which you can stand to challenge them. That's my point. And if you didn't get that, I think everybody else did. Now, I can understand. Look, this is, I don't know what else you've written. Maybe this is one of your first books. Therefore, you're very sensitive that I dared to even talk about it. I didn't say, oh, this guy is an idiot or anything. I didn't. I just simply said, you know, this really concerned me because it speaks to something that I have mentioned many, many times before, and that is, I see in a lot of modern Christian scholarship, quote-unquote, a fundamental fear of confessing the lordship of Christ in the face of worldly opposition. Now, I know those people are making the very same commitment to their own ultimate authorities, and they don't realize it. But I have seen so many times New Testament scholars as well, since they seem to be the only ones that can actually talk about this, according to this book, New Testament scholars as well, that don't mind holding positions that clearly Jesus didn't hold, and yet they call themselves New Testament scholars. Why? Well, because they really do want to be at the table. And to be at the table, at least in this context, and certainly how I've used it and how Geisler was using it, and what you were responding to, involved those very presuppositions that are completely antithetical to the fundamental assertions of the Christian worldview. And so all I was saying was, man, this concerns me. This concerns me. Then, you know, I want to make sure to look at everything that's here. White then thinks that my statement about having a Christian be a trusted authority in each field is problematic. Can that be given outside of the worldview? Sometimes, yeah. Who is it that heads up the Human Genome Project? A Christian like Francis Collins. Okay, but is Francis Collins consistent in his Christian worldview? No. And as apologists, well, at least for me, as I do apologetics, inconsistency is a sign of a failed argument. And once again, there is going to be, Jesus said, do not be surprised if the world hates you, because it hated me first. when you're dealing with rebellious scholars who have not bowed the knee to Jesus Christ, there is an antipathy to everything that is true, just, and righteous. And this is where, in so much of modern evangelicalism, in the William Lane Craig, non-reformed, apologetic world, where everybody jumps off the bandwagon and says, no, I don't really believe in that radical total depravity stuff. But it's absolutely biblical, and we see it around us every single day. There is a radical antipathy to what is good, right, honest, and just. These people will not bow the knee to Jesus Christ, and they will not share that table with anyone who does. That's all I was saying. And for me, exercising scholarship under the Lordship of Christ is not something you do under a bushel. You don't sneak to church on Sunday and hope that none of your colleagues that you work with on Monday know you do that. I don't see how that glorifies Christ. But a lot of people are doing it. A lot of people are doing it. He says the Christians should be seeking to dominate academia and be the most learned people they can be. I'm trying to figure out where that comes from in the New Testament. Especially in light of 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2, I would not say that. What I would say is that Christians whom God gifts to engage in the field of scholarship, to the best of, they should pursue that calling to the best of their ability. But I would not say that every Christian is called to do that, because they're not gifted to do that. If you're called to engage in academic pursuits, then do it to the glory of God, and do it without hesitation and without embarrassment at bowing the knee to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, that the beginning of true knowledge is the fear of the Lord. But this idea basically is that, well, I mean, how would we dominate academia in a nation under the judgment of God? How would that work? I mean, I don't know what Nick Peters' eschatology is, but almost sounds post-mill here. But even a good post-mill is going to recognize that America or Western culture today is not the kingdom of God, and therefore there may well be judgment that comes upon a culture that ends up destroying that culture, and during that period of time, Christians will be a small minority. How would they dominate academia? I don't get that. White goes on to say that there are many people who are embarrassed by the open confession of the Lordship of Christ over every area of knowledge. Again, this is the kind of accusation that would have been good to make absolutely sure of before making a statement about it. Huh? You saying that's not a true statement? This especially since he has no idea where it is that I'm coming from, and yet seems to know exactly where I'm coming from. I wasn't talking about you. I was making an absolute statement that there are many people in academia who are embarrassed by the open confession of the Lordship of Christ over every area of knowledge. Try going into any secular institution and making that claim. And see what happens. How many Christians are willing to do that? Willing to stand up and make that statement today? That's not even a debatable thing. White has said how Dan Wallace endorses the book. I'm sure Wallace would have told him as well that White's position on me is false. What position on you? That's what I didn't get on this. What position on you? You seem to be taking general statements and saying, well, you must be talking about me. Missed it. Missed it badly there. You know what I'm going to try to do? If you're awake out there, that's enough there. I think I've made my point on that. It's becoming sad. I do want to try to sneak one thing in real quick. And I'm going to have, I realize I'm going to have to change the doohickey wobber here for, and you're going to have to play around with it and stuff like that. I just want to show y'all something. This is sort of a preview. Okay? This is a preview. Safari, there. Do you have the video? Okay. This is a preview. I want to review this, but I want you to see it first to give you an idea. I'm not even just watch it. And what's going to bug you is it's 7 minutes 30 seconds long, so it's going to take us past our time by about 2 minutes 30 seconds. But I'm not going to respond to it yet. And I don't know when I'm going to get around to doing it. But I'm going to show it to you anyways because we are going to respond to this. Maybe we'll do it tomorrow. We can sneak that in with William's call. But this is from these guys in London called Dawa Made Easy. If this doesn't show you the fact that we need to study to show ourselves approved and be ready to give an answer, watch.
Preacher, theologian, is unable to answer some basic questions about Jesus. Please don't be disturbed by what he does at the end. Thank you for watching.
We haven't had a conversation, have we, my friend?
No.
Okay. And you very kindly agreed to be filmed, and you're going to give us the message of
the gospel.
The message of the gospel.
Yeah.
And you said you're a born-again Christian, is that right?
Born-again Christian.
Born-again Christian, okay, fine. And while we were setting up the camera, you told me your name is Daniel, is that right?
Daniel.
You're clearly well-knowledgeable, and while we were setting up the camera, you said you're a student of theology?
Yes.
Okay, so you're a student of religion.
Religious studies and theology.
Religious studies and studies. Religious studies and theology. A theologian, that's brilliant. So nice to have an expert to talk with for a change. And your name is Daniel, okay? And you preach the message as well of Jesus, of the message of the gospel. You're a preacher?
I'm an evangelizer.
Evangelizer means to give dawah, yes. To spread the message. The question I'd like to ask you is that, Daniel, do you believe Jesus is God, or do you believe Jesus was somebody sent by God? You're a preacher, you're well knowledgeable, you're a theologian, student of theology, so what is the position of Jesus? Is he God, or did God send him?
I have to ask you, do you want me to answer that theologically? And when I say theologically, do you want me to present this evidence from the Old Testament and the New Testament, or the Old Testament or the New Testament?
Okay. And what I would say to you is this, Daniel.
Would you like me to present this historically as well?
Okay. If I said to you, for example, if I saw somebody and I said to you, is this a man? If you asked me, is this a man standing here or is it something else? And I said to you, would you like me to answer this theologically or from the Quran or from the Hadith or from the old message or the new message or historically? It doesn't make sense. I mean, a man is a man. You know what I mean? Or for example, if I said to you, is it day or night at the moment, and you said to me, shall I answer it theologically or historically? It's just, is it a day or night, or is it a man or a woman? Simple question, is he a man or not? That's the point.
Is Jesus a man?
Yes.
Jesus is not a man.
Jesus is not a man, okay.
Was a man.
Okay, Jesus was a man. Okay, fantastic. But is he God? Or was he somebody sent by God?
Both.
So Jesus is God and he was sent by God as well. So he sent himself.
Yes.
God sent himself to the earth.
Yes.
Okay. So Jesus has all the characteristics of Almighty God?
Yes.
Okay. But in the Bible, Jesus, for example, can we agree about God that God doesn't... Can we agree that God is almighty? He's all-powerful. He is the Alpha and the Omega, which means the first and the last. There was no one before him. There will be no one after him. He knows everything. He sees everything. And he hears everything. Would you agree that about God?
The major debate in the second century, in the patristic period, was the deity of Christ. Now, this period...
So you're saying 200 years after Jesus, there was a debate about whether Jesus is God or not?
No. I'm talking about 100 years off into the 2nd century. It was the discussion about the nature of Christ, because we know Christ to be, when he was on earth, to be human and to be divine. Now, there is many evidences of Jesus having a human nature. For it says in verse 14, the Word became flesh. Now, there are also...
Very complicated. Sorry. For most people, this would be too complicated. What I'm saying to you... Yeah. Sorry. You have to simplify. You see, we're not theologians like yourself, and we don't know this complex thing. But what you're saying is 100 years after Jesus left the earth, there was debate whether he was God or not.
No, I'm saying that they were discussing the human nature of Christ, and the
a cup of coffee in London. our brother, who actually lives in Milwaukee, but claims that I was in London, he says, "Why painful should stop listening to the dividing line in bed? We're causing people in London to have."
The divine nature of Christ.
And they weren't sure whether he's God or not.
No, they were just discussing it. Now,
you can only discuss something if you're not sure. If I said to you, is it day or night? Clearly you'd say, yes, it's day. We don't need to have a discussion on it. But 100 years after Jesus left the earth, they were discussing whether Jesus is God or not. That's what he's saying.
So, it says in Zechariah 700 BC...
There is a 45-minute version of this. I noticed it there. I personally would not be able to survive 45 minutes of this. You got to give the Muslims some credit here for a certain level of patience. I would love to be on the Unbelievable radio broadcast with this Muslim. So, if someone can contact him... Please? That would be really enjoyable. I'd like to. Can I answer these questions? Can I come on Dawah is Easy? I'll meet you. I'm going to be in London. I'll meet you. And won't take 45 minutes. No, won't.
CE by the prophet Zechariah, it says, this is, I'll just read it. And I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one who mourns for his only son and grieve for him who grieves of a firstborn. Now that's Jesus Christ. Christ died on the cross. He was pierced and he said, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Jesus Christ is the beginning. Jesus is the beginning and the ending, the beginning and the last. And they who pierced him will see him coming down in glory. Jesus. That's it.
Sorry. It looks like Muslims are one. Sorry. It looks like Muslims are one. You're walking away.
That's Jesus.
You're speaking in tongues?
That's Jesus. That's Jesus.
Sounds like you're having a fit or something. Sorry. One second. Sorry. It looks like you're having a fit.
That is Jesus.
No. You asked him. You asked him, right?
If he can speak in tongues.
So he's speaking in tongues, right?
Yeah, that's what he wants. That's what he
wants. Wait. You asked him if he can speak in tongues.
So he's doing that.
He said to you,
he can.
When he's in the Holy Spirit, he can speak in tongues.
Listen
to what I'm saying. When the Holy Spirit touches you, you can't stay still.
Yes. Is that what happened to him?
That's
what happened to him. But it looks like, to most people, it looks like he couldn't answer the questions.
No, you didn't allow me to speak.
Daniel, one second. Is the Holy Spirit in you now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It says in the Bible, when the Holy Spirit is in you, then poison won't affect you. Could you drink some poison? One second, Michael. No, Daniel, it looks like Muslims have won again. You're a preacher, you're a theologian, you're running away. And even Michael's running away.
I'm not running away.
Okay, you're just running away.
I'm not running away.
It looks like the Muslims have won.
But what have you won? It wasn't
said that's enough.
He said God told him it's enough because you can't answer the questions. You know, but it looks like Muslims have won.
But
he said God told him he's had enough and he should go away.
Well, there you go, folks. I only apologize slightly for torturing you with that. But What can I say? Unfortunately, for a lot of Muslims, that's the Christianity that they've seen. And when you're prepared, when you can actually provide answers, correct misapprehensions, wow, what a blessing you can be. What a blessing you can be. So we'll look a little bit more at the quote. Of course, my problem is, why call him a Christian scholar? He clearly isn't a Christian scholar. That's just unfair. But anyways, that's what's coming up. I don't know when. Tomorrow morning, maybe we'll make some comments on that. Maybe William will call in. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow morning, but it'll be the only other dividing line for the week, because after that, we are traveling. So we'll do our best. We'll see if we can get hold of John Sampson. He may find out. Oh, you got hold of him? Oh, okay. John Sampson's going to be helping us out, so excellent. We will be back, Lord willing, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. our time, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We'll see you then. God bless.